The following program is brought to you by We Are Many. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out wearemany.org.
So I'm just gonna get right into it. 60s and 70s were marked by a massive left shift in social consciousness. The radicalization existed everywhere. Movements were forming in all areas of people's lives. They were the ones demanding change on their own behalf. Struggles in the workplace, against racism, for women's lives, against the war in Vietnam, against poverty. This period should remain a significant marker for radicals, a decades-long revolutionary incubation for us to dig into for lessons and inspiration. And healthcare was another major struggle in this period as well. Healthcare workers and professionals, people underserved or neglected by the healthcare system, all organized in different ways to address their immediate health needs, and also pointed out the relationship between healthcare, poverty, racism, sexism, and democracy. The history of healthcare in the US can be understood by what Beatrix Hoffman, a professor of history at Northern Illinois University, describes as the rationing and right to healthcare. Rationing is about access, about who gets care, and more importantly, who doesn't, who is explicitly or implicitly denied. It should be of no surprise that those who are most often denied access were likely to exist on the margins of society. There are gaps in access along many lines, like that of class, race, and gender. The main motivation to ration healthcare is to save money, but it is also often intended to make money. Insurance companies deny coverage to high-risk buyers in order to appear more valuable to shareholders. Rationing in the US leads to too many services for some and too few for others. The right to health care, quoting sociologist Theodore Marmor, is equal access to equivalent medical services. Although ideas about health care rights have been around for at least a century, the notion took on new meaning after the 1920s because of the dramatic rise of medicine's effectiveness. In other words, it's much harder to argue scarcity when advances in medicine like anesthesia and antisepsis are becoming more commonplace. That said, these and other advances also greatly increased the cost of healthcare. The question became who would carry the burden. Often the question of the human right to healthcare is pitted against the need to define limits to it, to control costs and access to those who aren't in need. This ignores the reality that healthcare has always been rationed in the US. It forecloses the debate on how benefits could be distributed in a period like today where we possess a healthcare infrastructure that can actually be reorganized to reach way more people. It was on these bases that people organized in the 60s and 70s in order to gain access to or create their own means of healthcare. The importance of social movements, working class self-activity, and organization cannot be understated here, as I will have hopefully laid out the relationship between social movements and a demand for universal healthcare is critical, and one cannot exist without the other. The success of sweeping health proposals relied on those movements to give it a mass character and pressure that could not be ignored by the ruling class. Before the passage of Medicare and Medicaid in 1965, many attempts were made to pass some form of universal coverage, including a compulsory health insurance system proposed by the American Association of Labor Legislation, or AALL, in 1915, the Committee on the Cost of Medical Care in the 20s and 30s, and again in the 40s when labor joined with the Committee for the Nation's Health and a liberal administration under President Harry S. Truman in drafting the Wagner-Murray-Dingell Bill. None of these attempts succeeded, with only AALL's compulsory health insurance proposal going as far as to pass in the New York State Senate in 1919, only to die in committee after some vigorous red baiting, which branded the plan insurance Bolshevism. The major causes of these plans' failures were the seizing of anti-communist sentiment in order to oppose them, the failure to get input and mobilize masses of people in support of these plans, and the concerted organization by their opponents, businesses, health insurance companies, and physicians under the banner of the American Medical Association, or the AMA. The unique gains that the AALL plan was able to make in New York only occurred after local labor leaders defied direction by the AFL president Samuel Gompers, who opposed it, and women trade unionists and suffragists who adopted the proposal for its protections for women workers, which included maternity benefits. In about this same period, the rise of private health insurance as an alternative came. Following World War II, private coverage took off with 125 million people having some form of coverage by 1960. It's about 70% of the population at the time. Federal tax breaks under President Eisenhower created an incentive for businesses to buy coverage for their workers, and unions increasingly won health coverage through collective bargaining in lieu of pursuing universal health coverage through legislation. Labor would remain a major supporter of universal health care throughout the 20th century, but a significant layer of workers had been accommodated, dwindling the possibility of a mass movement around healthcare. The struggle for a national health plan would then be up to the underinsured and uninsured. A major part of this group turned out to be the elderly and their campaign for Medicare. Medicare represented, in the friendliest terms, a strategic retreat for reformers. By targeting the elderly, it would appear less harmful to the AMA and private insurers' interests and could be attached to Social Security and funded through payroll taxes. It was adopted by the AFL-CIO, who feared the cost of bargaining for retirees' health benefits would erode the wages and protections for younger workers. John F. Kennedy supported Medicare as senator under Eisenhower, and it was a major platform for his 1960 presidential campaign. As a response to hopefully undermine Medicare, the AMA supported the Kerr-Mills Bill, which passed in Congress in 1960 and offered federal grants to states for assistance to the very poor and elderly only. By this point, however, it was becoming very evident that a majority of elderly people, not just the very poor, needed assistance, and the Kerr-Mills Bill did not come close to providing adequate coverage. In 1958, people over the age of 65 represented 9% of the U.S. population. Having more problems due to age, the elderly spent 50% more on medical care and nearly 100% more on hospital care and medication than people under 65. Private insurance companies considered this a costly risk and engaged heavily in denying coverage to the elderly. Nonprofits like Blue Cross tried to maintain coverage through increased premiums, but the costs were too great for senior citizens, meager Social Security checks to cover alongside daily living expenses. One 67-year-old woman whose insurance was cut after paying for it for 11 years sent in a letter to her senator, "I therefore feel very strongly that we need Medicare under such circumstances. We think it is simply outrageous for insurance companies to get so much money over the years and then let people out in such a manner." Even industry executives predicted that private insurers' unwillingness to cover the elderly would come back to bite them in the form of calls for government intervention. Where previous attempts at passing reform failed, this next bout succeeded precisely because of the organization and involvement of the people directly interested in seeing Medicare pass. The AFL-CIO formed the National Council of Senior Citizens, which was a pivotal force in generating support for Medicare. They engaged in massive letter writing campaigns to other elderly people and held mass rallies across the country. One rally at Madison Square Garden had 20,000 attendees with John F. Kennedy as a speaker. Mouth is dry and I only have coffee. Despite the AMA's concerted efforts to smear Medicare as socialized medicine, you are an angel. Despite the AMA's concerted efforts to smear Medicare as socialized medicine and an all-out propaganda campaign in doctors' offices, not all patients reacted in their favor. One person from Oklahoma said, "When I go to a doctor, it is for medical and surgical help, not political advice on matters which he seems to have a personal or selfish interest in." To add to the losing battle, the Medicare bill was expanded to include Medicaid, a national health care program for the poor. By 1962, 69% of seniors supported Medicare. After Lyndon B. Johnson was elected president in 1964, Medicare had full support of seniors, labor unions, and civil rights leaders who saw its passage as providing further means to end racial discrimination in healthcare for black families who were poor and underserved. Medicare and Medicaid were huge wins for providing healthcare to the elderly and poor, but it was a partial victory that needed to be built upon in order to provide coverage for the millions of working people who still did not have insurance, were being pressed down by the rising cost of healthcare. The annual growth rate in the cost of medical services rose from 3.2% to 7.9% after Medicare was passed. Healthcare costs were rising at an increased rate, and a flaw in Medicare's structure left a loophole for doctors and hospitals to inflate fees and give unnecessary services to patients. By 1968, healthcare reformers were again looking at a national health plan. One of its leading advocates, United Auto Workers President Walter Reuther, put out a call for a comprehensive national health insurance program. He noted that 40% of the population lacked adequate health care and that what we have, in fact, is a disorganized, disjointed, obsolete non-system of health care. He announced the formation of the Committee for National Health Insurance. Its members included medical school deans, progressive liberals, notable black activists like Coretta Scott King and Whitney Young, and members of the Medical Committee for Human Rights. The formation of the Medical Committee for Human Rights, or MHCR, or MCHR, started with healthcare professionals who volunteered to provide medical care for the civil rights activists organizing in Mississippi in 1964. It came to represent the medical arm of the civil rights movement and the New Left, establishing chapters in major cities while maintaining a stronghold of medical activism in Mississippi following the Freedom Summer Project. They also provided first aid in protests and campaigned to desegregate hospitals in the South. But the organization quickly came face to face with inadequacies in healthcare in the North as well. After winning hospital integration, activists faced the problem of ensuring African Americans got medical care. The desegregation of hospitals happened more smoothly than that of schools, in no small part due to the financial incentive to hospitals that Medicare and Medicaid provided. But desegregation was still slow going, and activists understood that legal desegregation and civil rights would not in itself bring about racial equality in healthcare. Despite the gains from Medicaid and the Civil Rights Act, many states, hospitals, and physicians refused to accept Medicaid, leaving a huge gap in healthcare for African Americans. When a team of MCHR physicians visited a hospital in Kentucky built with the funding from the Hill-Burton Act, the hospital charged a deposit of $50 to access care, a fee which would have eliminated most black patients from receiving care. Hospitals built with federal funding from bills like the Hill-Burton Act could not discriminate on the basis of race, color, or creed, but a combination of loopholes in legal language and poor oversight allowed hospitals to circumvent that. African Americans had to organize their own institutions like the medical committee, life insurance companies, and community health, public health movements. Perhaps the most significant achievement in the fight for health justice to come out of this period was the comprehensive community health center movement. Millions of people, primarily people of color who lived in poor urban communities and rural areas in the US, desperately needed adequate health care. Black communities faced epidemics of hypertension, diabetes, and infant mortality. Health workers and activists like H. Jack Geiger, Count Gibson, and Bob Smith held discussions which led to the Office of Economic Opportunity, funding in 1965 the first two health centers in Boston and Mound Bayou, Mississippi. These centers would be models for future health centers. Jack Geiger is a physician and activist who helped found organizations like MCHR and the Committee for Health in South Africa. It was his experience in South Africa while studying there that helped form the basis for community health centers in the US. He witnessed how a community health model led to vast improvements in the health of Zulus who were being ravaged by apartheid. Because of the mechanization of the cotton industry, many sharecroppers were left without jobs and the means to access health care. Bolivar, the county which held Mound Bayou, had an unemployment rate of 50%. Mississippi would also not join the Medicaid program until 1971. These activists knew that basic health care could not address the root causes of poverty, and so envisioned these centers as an agent of social change by providing health care, but also by addressing the social determinants of health through employment, environmental interventions, housing repair and development, a massive self-help nutrition program, community organization for economic and political empowerment, and above all, the provision of educational opportunity. Community organization was key to the success of these health centers. Joe Disparity, a healthcare worker and civil rights organizer, spread the word about the center in Mound Bayou by going door to door and identifying people who could work there and serve on the advisory board. John Hatch, a veteran black activist and physician, worked to win over would-be opposition, such as local physicians who saw the center as competition and black power militants who opposed what they saw as invasion by a white institution. He also gathered information about health, nutritional, and other needs of the community through one-on-one conversations, small group meetings, and large community meetings. Direct involvement and participation by community residents was crucial to the success of the program. The community controlled the centers and leadership through community health associations. The center's existence brought further light onto patients' needs beyond illness and found enterprising ways to attack some of those issues. As one resident in the Mississippi region put it, "I've been sick sometime, always broke, sometimes hungry, and never lived in a decent house. I do believe that one begets the other." To address the problem of malnutrition and starvation, especially among children, Geiger began writing prescriptions for food. In response to objection by a government bureaucrat, he said, "The last time we looked in the book, the specific therapy for malnutrition was food." Hatch later helped organize the North Bolivar Farm Cooperative with 1,000 families cultivating 500 acres of land, which produced hundreds of tons of vegetables annually by 1970. GED programs and occupational training were also organized at the center. By 1975, the center produced 7 physicians, 5 PhDs in clinical sciences, 2 environmental engineers, 6 social workers, numerous nurses, and the first 10 black registered sanitarians in Mississippi history. The legacy of community health centers would last and expand past the 70s, but the movement was hurt by waning support from the federal government under Nixon. Changes in administrative control and reduced funding forced cutbacks in social programming like night schools and food provisioning. Healthcare workers, activists, and reformers knew that community health centers were not a substitute for a national program. Lively debates ensued in organizations like MCHR. Local projects like community health centers not only addressed immediate healthcare needs, but could spread the idea of universal healthcare. MCHR entered the national healthcare fray with an ad in the New York Times in 1967, attacking the AMA's historical antagonism to national health plans, and declared that healthcare is a human right, which all movements for human progress must encompass. Another major question in force in the provision of healthcare is the question of women's health and reproductive rights. To quote Hoffman again, the women's health movement of the 1960s and 70s is remembered more for its demands for reproductive justice and its powerful critique of the sexism of the medical profession than for advocating universal access to healthcare. She goes on to say, yet women's health activists did draw connections between the nature of U.S. rationing and the health system's treatment of women. The book Our Body, Ourselves argues that profit-driven medicine had led to an epidemic of unnecessary surgeries on women, especially hysterectomies, at the same time that women without access to primary care died of preventable cervical and uterine cancers. Similar to the community health centers, women organized their own independent feminist health clinics. Most provided reproductive services, but some also provided primary and preventive care as well. These clinics embodied the concept of control by women, self-help, the subversion of medical hierarchy, and free, low-cost, or sliding scale care. The Jane Collective was an underground abortion provider based in Chicago from 1969 to 1973. It was affiliated with the Chicago Women's Liberation Union. Illegal abortions were not only dangerous but expensive, so the collective sought to provide safer and more affordable abortion access to patients. They characterized abortion as a social problem that mirrored the oppression of women in social and political arenas. They performed more than 11,000 abortions up to 1973, disbanding after Roe v. Wade passed. Despite the organized and conservative role that physicians played in opposing abortion access, it was doctors' medical and political engagement with feminists that made it possible to initiate this reform. Abortion cases reached the Supreme Court through grassroots movement in which both groups played a prominent role. Women, as patients and political actors, moved physicians to a more radical political position. As they had for generations, women insisted that the medical profession listen. Though these discussions often took the form of nasty debates, even pickets, much of the medical profession heard the feminist message, just as they had individually heard their individual patients' demands. Demands for safe and legal abortions are often narrowly portrayed as emphasizing individual rights or the right to privacy based on the Supreme Court's reasoning on its Roe v. Wade decision. Initially, the debate was focused on opening up legal space for physicians to perform abortions. A small group of physicians and public healthcare workers in the mid-1950s initiated these first efforts to reform abortion laws alongside progressive lawyers. As women entered this discussion, they brought with them their own experiences to develop the analysis. Feminists argued a new meaning of abortion. Rather than being an individual need, private crisis, or public health problem, it was a collective problem for all women, and that the criminal status of abortion was a fundamental feature of the subordination of women. It was the changing political context of the 60s and 70s and the radicalization that it produced which opened the possibility for a mass movement for women's health. Abortion rights could absolutely be a part of a broader critique of the healthcare system. For example, the Young Lords Party, the New York chapter of the Puerto Rican leftist organization, and one of the few of its kind to support abortion access, protested the death of a Puerto Rican woman during a legal abortion in a New York City hospital. They charged that her treatment proved that legal abortion was not the answer for poor and third world women who did not have access to quality care. They then demanded community control of healthcare institutions. Women in Latino and Black power organizations like the Young Lords argued for an approach to reproductive rights which would encompass the right to be free from forced sterilization as well as control over their fertility. The Delta Health Center, another community health center in the South, argued that women's reproductive health could only be understood within a broad context of healthcare, which included access to primary care, decent housing, and sufficient food. Working class women's organization focused on maternity insurance and affordable childcare and strongly asserted healthcare as a right, as in the case of women endorsing a Declaration of Rights of Women Workers that included healthcare at a rank and file action conference in Chicago in 1970. The Coalition of Labor Union Women in the 1970s strongly criticized discrimination against women in health insurance, including higher premiums or non-existent maternity coverage. An important victory for working women was the Pregnancy Discrimination Act of 1978, which requires employers to treat pregnancy the same as covered disabilities. Women labor leaders noted that the majority of underinsured and uninsured were women, And because women were most concentrated in part-time, temporary service, and domestic work, sectors with no benefits, employment-based coverage implicitly discriminated against women. Women would continue to be prominent participants alongside labor unions and civil rights activists in national health struggles well into the 1970s. New openings for a universal health program existed in this period. In August 1971, New York Times ran a front page article that declared that Americans from all strata of society and all economic classes are swinging over to the idea that good health care, like a good education, ought to be a fundamental right of citizenship. In 1971, there were 22 competing health care bills in Congress. The newly formed Committee for National Health Insurance held its first conference on women in universal health care. The 1971 National Convention of MCHR was held in Philadelphia, and its theme was the consumer in healthcare, which drew in huge numbers of women, blacks, non-professional health workers, and people who sought healthcare and demanded to be represented in the fight for a universal plan. Called consumers, the concept was that people could gain knowledge about healthcare and the health system and could then make informed decisions individually and collectively. Despite consumerism being a conservative force, in this case it represented an anti-establishment, anti-corporate edge and active participation by those who wanted access to healthcare. The consumer movement of the 1970s emphasized the rights of patients to be protected from industry abuses over the right to access healthcare for all. In other words, regulation and not a fundamental change to the health system. But one of the successes of the consumer movement was action taken into ending insurance discrimination based on race and gender. Even President Nixon had his mind on healthcare. The rising costs to maintain Medicare and Medicaid and the growing crisis in the medical system posed the possibility that a national program was likely to be passed. Nixon's proposal included the formation of health maintenance organizations, a form of prepaid insurance provision that provided a limited list of services for a fixed cost, and the employer mandate, which would require businesses to provide insurance for workers. The socialized medicine of the past, denounced by conservatives, became the corporate reform of the 70s. The AMA, notoriously opposed to any kind of government provision of health, even proposed a plan that, while conservative, and which placed private insurance at the center, was an ideological leap for the organization. They dubbed it MediCredit, much like Obamacare. It offered federal tax credits to those who purchased private insurance and provided a Medicaid-like plan for the poor. Senator Edward Kennedy proposed sweeping national compulsory insurance that would cover everyone. He said, "We ought to have one set of standard benefits for all Americans, and it ought to be a quality set of benefits for all Americans. Not one set for the poor, one set for the middle income, and another for those that are employed and those that are unemployed." The Committee for National Health Insurance enthusiastically supported Kennedy's proposal, particularly for its elimination of means testing and cost sharing, which impacted working people the most. Nixon's proposal and the AMA's proposal maintained that healthcare was not a universal right and the government was not obligated to provide it. The two proposals would center private insurance companies to provide coverage. This angered proponents of universal healthcare, with United Auto Workers leader Leonard Woodcock angrily saying that the private insurance industry has failed to deliver the healthcare or protection that legitimately has been expected of it. Critics of Nixon's plan accused it of essentially subsidizing private health insurance companies. An MCHR spokesman put it, "The ruling class is figuring out how to give the people little national health insurance while giving itself a lot of profits." The medical committee actually opposed all major proposals, including Kennedy's. Quentin Young, chairman of the organization and founder of Physicians for a National Health Plan, said that Kennedy's bill was far and away the best one offered. They still opposed it for its funding system, which would place a heavier burden on the working class. They instead struck a far more radical line. The country needed a national health service, not national health insurance. MCHR's proposal, written by Thomas Bodenheimer, laid out a restructuring of healthcare in the US using the community health centers as a model. It would provide complete and comprehensive coverage to everyone for free. It would be funded through a progressive tax on total wealth. Medical schooling would be free and all healthcare workers would be salaried federal employees. Representation based on race and gender would be proportional to their population. All healthcare institutions would be run by consumers and by those who worked in the institutions, with consumers always in the majority. It was to be a community worker-controlled national health service. The MCHR proposal aimed to eliminate capitalism in healthcare. It was bold and audacious, but its major flaw was that it would never pass without the revolutionary weight and spirit in which it was written. Mainstream liberals were united behind Kennedy's bill. In hindsight, both Bodenheimer and Young agreed that the refusing to support Kennedy's bill was a mistake. The effort to achieve some kind of national legislation on health insurance failed during 1972. The drug and insurance industry stood to lose a lot if Kennedy's bill was passed. They were able to drive a wedge into the lack of consensus on a bill in Congress. Nixon expanded his plan, and Kennedy modified his to come to compromise. But labor leaders refused to budge on the original proposal. No mobilization from below occurred to pressure Congress to vote. Before too long, the Watergate scandal overshadowed national health insurance, and none of the bills came to a vote. At this point, the rising cost of health care caused the national plan to be tabled indefinitely. During Jimmy Carter's presidential campaign, he promised to put forward a national insurance plan, but once in office, his administration focused almost exclusively on cost control. In 1970, U.S. health spending reached $118.5 billion. The energy crisis and concerns over inflation caused Carter to fear that the cost of a national insurance plan would double in just 5 years. In 1978, healthcare spending had reached $206 billion. The New York Times columnist Tom Wicker argued that a national insurance program would actually be the best way to stop health costs from rising, but it was an argument that went mostly ignored. This period would shape how later healthcare reform would be posed, controlling the ever-rising cost of healthcare over providing people with coverage. By the 1980s, the U.S. had a healthcare system that embodied the worst of two worlds: extremely high and rapidly rising costs combined with growing inequality and millions of people without coverage. The 70s for healthcare represented a decade of major openings for a universal plan that never came to fruition. But the ultimate failure to achieve even the most conservative proposals probably had less to do with the lack of consensus in Congress or among movements, and more to do with the shifting political arena in the U.S. that was likely unavoidable. The critiques of the national healthcare non-system are especially resonant today. Organizations of women's, of blacks and Latinos, of workers, and of consumers had come to sharp conclusions about healthcare in the U.S., conclusions that we can still use to draw out meaningful debates and to organize around. There are many other struggles I have not mentioned in that are no less important and had huge impacts on radicalizing the conversation about health in the context of different social movements. In a nod to the teacher strike wave, which began in West Virginia, a state known for coal mines and a militant labor history, more than a third of mine workers in 1969 set off a series of wildcat strikes, demanding safer working conditions and protections from black lung. In the same year, 70,000 miners marched on the state capitol demanding black lung legislation, culminating in laws protecting miners that were normally blocked by the coal bosses. The National Welfare Rights Organization at its peak in 1969 had 22,000 dues-paying members. In 1970, they formed the Health Rights Committee. Their statement asserted that quality health care, both in prevention and treatment, is a basic right and should be provided for all people on the basis of need rather than the basis of income. They organized around picketing organizations like the AMA and the American Hospital Association. They mobilized welfare mothers like the sharp and brilliant Geraldine Smith to speak on issues of discrimination by healthcare institutions based on race, gender, and poverty. There was the deinstitutionalization movement, the advent of the disability rights movement in the 70s, the student health organizations, healthcare access organizing, and the gay and trans liberation movements, migrant workers, clinic organizing, and occupational health organizing, and many other struggles that I recommend learning more about, but I can't speak of in this talk. I think a major piece is that where healthcare struggles have failed, there was no massive support or little mobilization or organization. When we think about the fight for some kind of universal plan today, we must bring the debate to the people and get their input and buy-in. There are several ways to do that that don't necessarily preclude one another, like marches, canvassing, setting up working groups and unions, for example, to organize around healthcare, and connecting healthcare workers to the community. And we must also rebuild what we've lost since the 70s. The decline in the fight for health justice in this period is aligned with the overall decline in social movements and labor militancy that defines the arrival of the neoliberal era. The smashing of unions, the decline in working class quality of life, and the ability to fight back. The dissolution of many of these once massive organizations, these consequences were likely inevitable, but they give us necessary insight into the forces at play in our struggles today. A common conclusion that is drawn that many of the movements fighting for health justice were too particular to generate a critique of, and therefore a movement for, national health. But the opposite is actually true. A critique of national health could be found in the seeds of these smaller struggles. On one hand, it could be argued that because different groups were overly focused on their own access, a universal critique could not be put forward with the united force of all these different organizations aligned in struggle. This assertion belies the reality that where a major force in where a major win in the fight for universal healthcare occurred, many different groups, from healthcare workers and civil rights activists to labor unions and women liberationists, organized together, debated, formed strategy, and fought in the streets, in the courts, and in the hospitals. These movements were not without their challenges, failures, and schisms, but no movement ever is. What we take from that for today probably seems a little bleak at first. We need to rebuild our unions, our community, and social movement organizations. We are in the beginning of a period of mass radicalization. How long it will last depends on forces outside our control, but also our ability to build sustained organizations designed to weather the low points as well as it can seize the opportunities of the upticks. In the case of healthcare, it means drawing the link between our ability to fight for and win a universal health plan with the strength of our other organizations. Many organizations do exist that focus specifically on healthcare, but it will take everyone from nurses to workers to once again put up a fight for healthcare for all.
The preceding program was a production of WeAreMany.org, a website dedicated to publishing radical and activist media that promotes a better understanding of today's world while also putting forward a vision for a better future. We Are Many is a project of the Center for Economic Research and Social Change. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out WeAreMany.org.